That's interesting. Wow. Hey, your level
I
of self-awareness is crazy. In fact, tell me about the burden of being self-aware, especially knowing that a lot of people who are not self-aware sometimes seem to be living a life full of vibes and inshallah. So these are not stressing them. When Rene thinks something is so deep, for me, I'm just like, I it's not that. Yani, people who are not self-aware seem to be happier. So talk to me about the burden of self-awareness.
You're speaking to my soul right there because I am constantly so envious of people who don't have like mad self-awareness. I feel like the oblivion looks so cute.
Right.
It's like they're just surviving, they're not in pursuit of anything, they're
Yes.
really into the simple pursuits. For me, the burden of self-awareness is like so proper because I think the burden of self-awareness has also pushed me to do to trying to find the most depth of myself. Like I at some point did shrooms. Like I really advocate for shrooms, by the way, and that whole thing was like I was just like, I think there is a part of myself that I have, self-preserved so much that I'm not able to connect with anymore. And I can just feel it in my soul. And I would love to know exactly what that is because I feel like I exist very authentically, but then I feel like there's a part of myself that I'm not connected to because, like, maybe I just locked her away too tightly. I don't know if it's my inner child. I don't know what it is. So the burden is consistently finding ways to go deeper, right? Like I'm talking, depends on how you do it. Some people go on the spirituality side or on the religious side, and you're like, oh my God, maybe that part of myself lies more and more devotion with God's sycophants, cults, that type of thing. But for some people, these other investments, like for me, I think, like shrooms, sensory deprivation tanks, all that type of stuff is always just an attempt to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And it feels sometimes like a never-ending cycle. Like, how much deeper can I get? Like, when is 100%? And so, I feel for me like I'm worried that when I'm not able to go deeper, like, will I lose my purpose in life? Will I lose the sense of existing? And will it just be empty? Or what if I get to 100%? And I just go like all Confucius and like life has no point anymore, right? So I'm constantly worried about that. The other burden is like, trying to help people get aware. Like, I think I spent so many years and hours of my life trying to trying to infect awareness into people. And I've just realized like, that's a waste of time. Like all you can do is practice your own self-awareness, and maybe the qualities and the characteristics you embody through that journey is what actually inspires someone to go through their own journey. But like sitting with someone, sitting with siblings, parents, trying to make them think, it's a complete waste of time. And I think for me, I carried that burden for very many years, being like, wow, I've seen the other side of self-awareness, and it's a beautiful existence, and it has purpose, and it has meaning, and I love it, and I wish that for the people around me, but it's not contagious. It's not inflicted. You have to just allow people to get to that level of their journey where they want to know more. And all you can do as a self-aware person is just be there and go through the journey with them. But trying to start their journey for them, trying to show them how to navigate their journey, like it's useless and it's actually a complete waste of time. So, yeah, I think, that is one of the biggest burdens around self-awareness I've ever discovered. Trying to change, trying to make people aware, it's so futile.
Yes. And as well, you just mentioned about psychedelics. Talk to me about psychedelics one and what your thought process is around that, especially in a very conservative society that frowns upon anything that I don't know if you call it Western or anything they're not accustomed to. Just like you talked about, in your profession, Adderall is normal when you enter San Francisco, but now in Kenya, it's just like everyone be like, bro, what are you doing?
You're on mental health medicine.
Yeah, so like, talk to me about that because I think you're also a global citizen, which is something I aspire to be one day. Because being a global citizen, as you rightly put it earlier, opens your mind and makes you think outside the box and outside the bubble you've lived in. So for me, that would be Kenya because you saw all the you just the constant echo chamber of just listening to the same things, but not, you know, uncolonizing and decolonizing your mind. So to me, about one, psychedelics, I'm not thinking about that. And then also you talked about, you know, your purpose in life. So have you really found your purpose in life? And if so, how did you come to finding your purpose in life? Because I think that's another thing where a lot of people are talking about, you know, I'm still trying to find my purpose. What is my purpose? So talk to me about those two things.
Yeah, I think for me, like, I had a whole stint, especially between the age of 23 and 25, where I was very convinced that to learn about myself is to learn about my history and to really understand where I came from and some of the structures that govern the way we live, right? So I've read a lot of, like, African history literature and, like, trying to understand the role of colonialism in our ideals and all of that. So I have a lot of loose information in my mind about that. And for me, there's actually a book that my dad recommended that my partner got me, which is around Luo clans and Luo practices and Luo traditions, because I think I'm more connected to my maternal culture, which is Taita, compared to my paternal, like my dad's culture, which is Luo. So yes, I have these Luo names, but depending on like my skin tone is more like light skin. So even when I'm home in Luo land, I'm like not feel like people can kind of, okay, we already know you're like an outsider, right? And so I'm more connected and very much more comfortable in my mom's culture. I also grew up in this culture a lot in terms of like upbringing. And so when I started reading more about Luo culture and actually reading documentation, seeing pictures and realizing that the use of like psychedelics and the use of mind altering substances has been ingrained in African culture from the beginning of time, like them using it to kind of like connect to a higher powers, like spiritually. So they do have like herbs in Luo culture that have psychoactive properties. And then also just going down that rabbit hole and realizing that a lot of the restrictions around the use of these substances were just kind of like made to be to restrict them to certain people. Like, yeah, they'll tell you how shrooms and LSD are banned, but you know, the people who actually have access to them, you know, get a lot of benefits from that on a mental health level. And these are usually the elites. So pairing that knowledge around the use of psychoactive substances in Africa and knowing that that's a part of my actual heritage, and then actually trying them for once and actually having very positive experiences. Like, yes, I did all the research. I knew, you know, to detox for 30 days, not drink, do certain activities, like hydrate, eat for a couple of days before. Like, I had a very fast, like my very first experience was extremely positive. Like, it was amazing. I feel like I connected with myself. It was my first experience realizing how much bigger than myself everything is, right? Like, I was just living in this bubble where everything around my life was dictated by my actions and the people I interact with. And that kind of made me zoom out and realize, like, whoa, my role in this whole thing is much bigger than what the people I'm interacting with. Like, I have a role to play as a human being. I have a role to play as a creature within this ecosystem. I have a role to play in history. Like, some of the activities I can do now can actually create opportunities for generations in the future. And that doesn't mean land. That means sharing my story and documenting our history and, you know, forming a narrative and, you know, even building a family tree so that the people who come after me can know who we were as people. Like, that for me came as inspiration of, hey, okay, you're busy, like you're super busy in your day-to-day life, but sometimes you need to take a step back and realize that you're one, a biological creature in a biological ecosystem, two, you are a part of a history and a timeline, and three, then you are yourself and you are how you treat yourself and how you see yourself. And so outside all of the noise of like, oh wow, this is so trippy and these colors and the walls are melting, outside that is just, you know, closing your eyes and sensory depriving yourself and diving into yourself and seeing some of those things. So I've consistently used psychedelics in a very controlled way, but it's also just been because I've had such positive experiences connecting to myself. And I know people have bad trips and everything, but I think that if you use them with intention, if you go into those journeys and those trips with very well planned out intentions, you can really learn so much about yourself because it is a space that removes you from your current reality, but you can use that to avoid your current reality, or you can use that to dive deeper into who you are and your body and your vessel and the role you're playing in the whole thing. So I'm so pro it. And it's not that it was also normalized for me. I do know that there's still so many misconceptions and myths, but I'm the kind of person who likes to rely on like research, perspectives, stories, narratives, and then deciding whether that's it for me or not. And yeah, I'm always going to have conversation with people who are like super against it. So I have like people in my life with a medical background and whatever. But then I'm going to also go to the people who I know use it week on like a weekly basis and see, all right, like those guys are going to be pretty honest about stuff like with dependency and everything. And so, I'm so pro it, and I'm also so pro microdosing because there's certain psychedelic, like certain psychoactive components used in small doses can actually help, manage things like depression, stress, better attention. So it's more about like finding out whether or not one, your body's going to react positively to it. So it's not typically advised for people who are on medication, like mental health medication and all of that. You shouldn't drink, you shouldn't take them when you're in like a bad mental space or under immense stress. So doing the research and actually also making sure that you are getting it from reliable sources. I've had people are being sold mushrooms from I don't know which river, which are not even mushrooms. Like you just eat them and then you wait for the trip and you paid 6,000 bob for them and then nothing happens. So it's also doing your research on like how can you test what you're putting into your body. I know there's kits people can use to test, and also getting them from reliable resources. So that's like my opinion on like psychedelics. I think you asked something else though. I don't know if I missed that.
But just to give a tune to that, as you said earlier, perspective, not advice, and that's solid.
Perspective, not advice.
Earlier, that's about purpose.
So
Your
purpose.
pop.
My idea on purpose is very maybe unconventional. I don't really believe in like a centralized life purpose. I think I rely a lot on realizing, like there's this video of Neil deGrasse Tyson explaining what the chances are of you existing in this very moment, right? Like he does the probability of, what were the chances that your mother was born, like in the whole lineage that could have possibly existed in your bloodline, there were a few people who are like 1 in 1,000 probability. You zoom chances of your grandmother giving birth to your mother, that's like 100 millionth chance. So thinking about the probability of you not existing is completely outweighed by the probability of you existing. Like you existing is like a 0. Zero by a millionth chance. And for me, thinking about that is like, all right, so in this world, there were probably, so we're 7 billion, there are probably 7 billion, billion people. But then why were these 7 billion the ones who are here? I feel like that's already like super special. And I think my purpose in life is already kind of fulfilled by the fact that I'm existing, by the fact that each year, I have actually made it. Like I could have died in the womb. I could have died in the morning. Like I'm still here for some reason. And the way that purpose will fulfill is by me continuing to exist. And I truly, truly believe that the day that you stop existing, that's the day that you actually fulfilled your purpose here. So that's you did all you could. Your journey has been determined to end at that point. And the lessons you are supposed to give other people, the lessons you are supposed to receive, all of those things have come into fruition. And that's how you end up leaving. So that's my reasoning on purpose. I don't think there's like a central purpose. I feel like because we are so interconnected to each other, a part of my purpose lies on my interaction with you right now. A part of my purpose lies in my work. A part of my purpose lies in how I treat people on a day-to-day basis. Like, I think my purpose is so distributed that there cannot be possibly one way to put it. And I think that I'm okay thinking about life like that. When I think of purpose as the one thing I was made to do, it trivializes my existence and it makes me feel like just a tool in a bigger story. And I don't like feeling like that. I don't like feeling like a higher power created me to do one thing and then I die. You know, like it feels like I'm a utility, right? So I like feeling like, oh, all right, I'm here. I get the opportunity to interact with people and each interaction is serving a purpose in someone's life. Like every bystander, every person you treat with kindness, every person you interact with, you played a specific role in their existence. And that sounds like a pretty good purpose to me.
And so with that, do you as well think that some of the reasons why a lot of people feel feelings of inadequacy, feelings of lacking behind is because they're chasing this one sole purpose? And therefore, since they're not meeting it, that's why they feel all sorts of, you know, imposter syndrome or self-doubt. Yet, as you've rightly put it, maybe your purpose is, you know, sometimes just to exist and just be, you know, you know. So do you feel that way?
Yeah, I feel like there's so much pressure to, like, first of all, I think that purpose, like, story, that purpose narrative, it forces us to make a lot of decisions we wouldn't have if we knew we were free to just exist. Like, I think we make a lot of decisions about our careers, our lives, our interactions, our relationships. Like, imagine thinking that you have this power to some extent, you might not even feel like it's feasible to be with the person that you actually truly love. You look at somebody, you guys have a great connection, and because you think your purpose is, I don't know, to be a billionaire or something, you'll be like, this person might not be the one to get me there, so I'm going to forfeit a genuine human connection to bring myself closer to this perceived purpose. But if you were actually told, if God like whispered in your ear right now and told you, listen, this is my voice, I created you, and the only reason you are created to be here is to just be here. Do you know how many different decisions you would be making on a day to day? Like, so much less pressure on yourself to do what you think you're supposed to be doing to reach your purpose, right? So I feel like, as you said, there's so much pressure that we put on ourselves because of that perceived notion of a centralized purpose. And I think it leads people to thinking even sometimes that you're way too off track from this perceived purpose. I think it might have led a lot of people to think that they're just too far gone to keep going. And I think it's a major contribution to, you know, a lot of like the numbers we have around suicide. And it also goes into a gender-based level because this notion of a centralized purpose is also somehow intrinsically divided according to, you know, to gender, because you rarely hear a lot of men saying my purpose is to be a dad or my purpose is to be a husband. You're told that your purpose is to be bigger. My purpose is to, you know, build something for a village or create a legacy. Those are so huge. But maybe your purpose is just to be a dad or to like just actually take your kid to school until then. Somehow, because you're able to even say which purposes are for men and which purposes are for women, which is so sick, right? Because when men are not fulfilling this, you know, preconceived purposes, then you find that there's a huge high rate for suicide in men, right? Because y'all are kind of boxed into a corner where your purposes are very limited. And if you just, if you veer off track even slightly, like, you're not going to fulfill your purpose, right? So I think there's a story there to explore around, you know, why, what purpose have we put in place that makes men feel like, you know, certain scenarios push them off track and make that so dire that people feel they need to like analyze themselves and stuff, because the numbers around like male suicides, they're crazy. They're shocking.
Yes.
And it's across cultures, it's across financial groups. It's like, there's billionaire men killing themselves. There's poor men killing themselves. There's people in villages, people in metropolitan cities. So there's something there that's just oddly crazy that's affecting men's mental health. And I have a feeling, I have a notion that that has something to do with it. But I feel like I want to even read more about that, to be honest, because
Yeah.
it's pretty crazy.
Good thing to hyperfixate on for our next
Yeah, like
episode.
you have no idea how I'm about to go on Reddit after this.
Because that's very interesting. I've never actually looked at purpose from a gender perspective now that you say that. Because it's actually now very mind-boggling that you say that. And even as you say that, can you please just pose me again with even for you, earlier you talked about, being an only child, and so at least at home, you didn't have to assume any gender roles. So if it's fixing the bike, you'll fix the bike with your dad. If it's cooking, you'll do all that good stuff. And so how, again, this manifests probably again in your romantic relationships, where you sometimes are told, as a woman you need to be in touch with your feminine inside, or the right man brings out your feminine inside. So how does that all that play out for you? Do you are you do you get over independent in relationships, like your man can't buy you a drink because now you know? So how does all this come to play for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me with the gender roles thing, at some point, I realized that I have to have a situation that doesn't demand me to be at 100% all the time, right? And I feel like that notion of what femininity looks like is the only part about that story about feminine energy that I relate to, right? Like, I feel that everybody deserves spaces that allow them to exist with ease. And I feel like relationships need to be that because the workplace demands you to be a certain way. There's rules, there's decorum. Your family, your extended family demands that of you. I feel like relationships are, they have the pressure to be the place where you can be 100% yourself and be free flowing. And that part, that aspect of free flowing is the thing that I've always felt like, okay, there's something about how I exist in relationships that I didn't feel free flowing. And that for me is the responsibility to solely make huge decisions, right? Like being the finance guy in the relationship, being the one who does all the research, the one who's thorough with everything, the one who, when they clean the dishes are truly clean. And like those types of things always used to make me feel a little bit off. So then my criteria for me to be like properly in my feminine energy is being able to rely on a partner to be able to do everything to that same level of like thoroughness and that same level of like responsibility. And that for me means that if my partner is not around and expects me to get the car stuff done properly, I should have they should have the ability to trust me to do that. And I've left my pets and I've left the house with my partner. Like I need to be in a space where I'm like, yeah, I don't have to worry about that. Like I know we have the same values, we value the same type of things that I don't need to worry about whether or not you're gonna like do things the right way or anything. So for me, that part of ease, that part of flow is the part that I relate to. But I think there's that aspect where we've made it look like there's natural things that should make a man feel easy, right? Like at the man should be able to lead, and that is their natural state, right? Which means that men who don't want to lead or don't feel like leading all the time feel like that's not masculine, right? Like
Yes.
I should want to be nice and clean and tidy and make sure that we have great meals all the time. So on the days where I don't give a F about what we're eating and the house is a mess, like that's gonna make me feel like I'm less feminine, right? So those type of societal expectations for me are the ones that have always kind of like been tricky, right? So I feel very at home making decisions and giving input and even taking lead of like investments and businesses and that type of stuff. But feels like that is supposed to be a rightfully masculine role. That's gonna make me feel like that part of myself that is very easy for me to be is not acceptable. You get. So
Yes.
I think with the current relationship I'm in is where I've properly explored the model where it's like it's not about who or what needs to be done. It's more about like I don't have to be the one to do it all the time and at 100%. So I can be on the days where I'm doing something at the days where you're at 20%, I bring in the extra 80. At the days when you're at 30, I bring in the 70. But at the day where I'm at a one, you should be 100% being the 99, right? And that's the
Yes.
balance. But you have to be very intentional with it because the scales tip when you're 6 weeks, right? Like you definitely need to have your partner have the space to be like, okay, I need to recharge. I need to be taken care of. I need this, right? So it puts pressure on yourself also that, yeah, I need to do the things I need to do, my self-care, myself, my taking care of my health so that I have the ability to bounce back up. So I don't expect my partner to bring me back to 100. I have to do the work myself to bring myself at 100 because I need to be there for them when they're at zero. Or
Yes.
if I'm at a 70, like I can at least they can be at a 30, but I don't need them to be at 100 all the time. They don't need me to be at 100 all the time. And that is with all activities. So yeah, some days I'm gonna wanna drive. We're going for long road trips because I have the energy to do it. I wanna do it. You're at 80, I'm at 80. Let's share it. Like you don't have to get depleted to 20 for me to bring my 80. So that for me has been how I've been navigating that. Like, and it's worked pretty well in this relationship. And I think that's kind of the notion I feel like I would want with partnerships moving forward.
Hey, where do the good ones go to hide away? Hey, times two.
Imagine
Hey.
like there's a cash shortage. There's a cash shortage. It's
Gonna short it. Hey, let
yeah.
us go to release a new bill. What?
Actually, guy, that will be a new bill soon because the way it's looking, you know, I
Hey.
was reading this thread about like at that moment when you start hitting you realize you've started hitting your girlfriend. Have you seen that
Bro,
thing trending?
I've
Like,
seen it. I was just like, this
way
is nuts.
mad,
Yanni,
mad.
that thread has more retweets and likes than anything I've seen in a
I'm
minute.
telling you, and like a dude saying, like you know you're at that point when she holds your hand and then you feel like cutting your own hand off. Like how do you get to a level where
Yanni,
me
you
holding your
actually.
hand, means you want to cut your hand off? Like
When she hugs you feel like she's mugging you. Bro, that's like, there's no, you guys, people,
no.
please date people who love you guys, because
My
there's no way.
as in that one for Maggie that had me. I was reeling like what? Yeah, hey, my neighbors probably think I'm crazy because sometimes I'm just reading stuff and I'm literally laughing out loud in my house.
It was too funny. It was just like, yo.
What?
And even your ex was just
Imagine,
reading all these things.
imagine. Like you're
Hey.
the one. Imagine you're the subject matter. What?
And that guy went off. Yanni, he wasn't stopping. I was just like,
All the
bro.
way. Oh my God, nothing was held back. Eh, but
Bad.
anyway, there's a patience you need to have. There's a patience, there's a self-preservation you need to have up in the streets because also I think too many people are desperate to be in relationships, like and see must.
See,
Like,
must.
yeah, see must. Like invest that energy to strengthen your relationship with your friends, pick a hobby. Like there's so many things to invest that energy in and not in an avoidance way. Like, yes, we do feel lonely, but it's possible to form genuine connections with the things that you have and the people around you instead of being super desperate to be in relationships because A, like that's the one thing that I think God said, you all need to let it go with the flow. Like this one you can't. Like this one, you have to wait for me to decide who it is and when they will come into your life. So the way you spend your time between now and then, that's what you need to focus on. Not looking for someone.
It's always the ones in happy relationships.
Huh?
Oh,
You
it's
are
like
giving
the ones
that
with
advice.
money.
Don't call me out.
It's like that with
You're
money. You know,
only
money
paying
then mean a lot.
me.
Money, that time, Renezani, I have an M on a small project. She's telling you, money doesn't matter a lot. This money thing.
Shut up, Billy. Shut up. No, I'm serious.
Hey,
Okay, I
let
feel
me just
bad.
call you out on the public platform.
We should do a, like if I'm ever single again, God forbid, we need to do a follow-up and see whether I'll be saying the same things. I'll be like, F men.
When we see
Men are
the
trash.
Instagram stories have shifted, we'll know. There will be signs. You won't say, but there will be signs.
Oh my God, but nuclei, like it's always the people in happy relationships, though.
It's always,
Mad.
just focus on yourself. The right person will come.
Yeah,
These
it's
things
like,
are.
yeah, don't force it. Ooh,
Lol.
lol.
But even as when the conversation on purpose earlier on, you talked about you just being drawn to the antagonist in stories probably prepared you for, a deeper level of life in the future. So let's talk about that a bit. And even, of course, we can't end the podcast without you talking about being a woman in tech and how that has been. I remember sometime you tweeted about, the predatory nature of people, the men in tech who are more advanced, but now preying on younger girls in the guise of mentorship. So let's talk about that. So definitely, as well, I've been on a panel with you as well, where, and we've even on the podcast, we've just talked about how you've always been the person to be headhunted. When other people are looking for jobs and crying that Kenya has no jobs, Rena can possibly hold 10 jobs, but she's being gracious and saying, let me just sit with this one. Let me not be too, this, let me not have the greed the Bible talks about. So talk to me about this, your how you've thrived in the corporate space, because a lot of us always have negative notions, but for you, clearly you've thrived and you're keeping on thriving. So tell me about all of that good stuff.
Honest thing is pretty like straightforward. I think just based off of like I've always envied how genuinely authentic the antagonists are portrayed. Like everybody kind of like expects them to be the worst versions of themselves, and so that gives them the freedom to be who they actually want to be. So being honest leaves room for some, because I think we all always felt people who self-prioritize are such. But now realizing that I might be the antagonist in a lot of stories because I chose me first, I chose to prioritize myself, like I'm okay with that. I'm okay with being perceived as selfish, self-centered, only looking out for themselves. And that's how you get branded the antagonist, because we've idealized and we've like completely glorified self-sacrifice and, putting the good of others before yourself, hero syndrome. Like, I don't even think that like we would be individual people or even have the opportunities to exist as individual people if that was okay. I need to be able to do what I need to do for myself. And if that makes me the bad guy, then I'm the bad guy, I guess.
I gotta put me first, Lucius.
I gotta put me first. I'm gonna do the best I can with what I got, Like, and I have to be there for the people who matter to myself. And I can't do that if I'm giving them everything. I can't pour from an empty cup. But I also know I can't expect other people to fill my cup. I have to fill my own cup, right? So
Yes.
I'm constantly like in these stories, in the people who have chosen that, like that path are the ones who are consistently branded the antagonists. And the people who are branded the protagonists are always the ones who, they suffer for the good of others and never of themselves. So I'm gonna pick the other side. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm not sorry. Yeah, so that's where that kind of comes from. With career, I mean, I can say I'm not gonna like, I know if my partner listens to this, he's gonna be like, don't say it's luck, but I'm gonna say that there's a huge part of luck. I wanna say it's been 90% consistency and authenticity, but I think there's a huge 10% of luck in there. Like, I feel like certain opportunities at certain times came up that allowed me to progress very quickly in my career, and I have to acknowledge that those opportunities were as a result of deliberately placing myself in certain rooms and in certain conversations. So I know that there are people who would have been there. Yeah, there are people who we were in the same rooms having the same conversations who did not get the opportunities I got. And that's the part I account to luck. And so I think it's been pretty interesting. I started off in the startup space. I started at a company called Africa Stocking, which do telecommunications APIs. And this is the first job I got after uni, right? So I did the whole couple of months in San Francisco, and then I came back, and I was invited to speak at a developer relations conference in Lagos, and that's where one of the recruiters and one of their team members at Africa Stocking gave me a card and asked me to show up at their office after Christmas. And so when I went, I met them and they gave me a job offer on the table. And I was always like, how lucky is it that they got into the room at the exact time I was giving my presentation, right? So I
Yes.
like, yeah, I did do a really pretty amazing presentation, but the timing, some of those things you could have never planned, right? So there's
Yes.
a lot of luck involved. So did that whole role for like two-ish years, and then moved to Sendy, the logistics company, and that was like where my product journey came up. And for me, product management just became a really cool space for me that I felt I could lean on a lot of my strengths on a personal level. So I get to interface a lot with stakeholders and customers. I get to be extremely organized and very well planned, which is something I just always have been naturally. And then I also get the opportunity to learn and grow and still be in engineering through product management. So I never wanted to let go of my engineering background. And luckily, because I didn't let go of my engineering and my coding background, I was able to, become a technical PM. And that's opened a lot of doors for me. So the stint at Microsoft was because of my technical background to a great level. And also now leading the product team at Food for Education is also means that I have to really be involved in the technical side. So that part of luck is that, yes, I did do the computer science degree at Strath. Yes, I was an engineer. Experiences were going to amount to anything outside being an engineer, but imagine I'm not an engineer now, and that experience is still kind of what has provided more opportunities for me, and I think that part is extremely lucky. Another quality I would say, like for real, has helped me is just like having, and I don't think we balance out the conversations. We talk a lot about, not existing in the capitalist machine, quiet quitting, just give the hours and nothing more. But I would say, like, yes, you have to have this balance of give the company and your role as much time as you give yourself. So that's the work-life balance that I like to have. Not that, F the machine, I'm only gonna give my stipulated hours. If I have to do other things within my work that will allow me to grow in an individual hours, I'm sorry,
But
but
I
I
will
will
do
do
it.
it. Like, I will actually do it because I know that that is serving myself. That's helping me grow myself. So I advocate for that level of of balance. And I know that early in my career, I had such strict time management skills in terms of like the amount of time I gave the company, I think I would have learned more about myself. I think I would have learned more in terms of like upskilling myself. So that's something I wish I started earlier. But I would also say, like, let's balance out. Like, yeah, we are just, we're doing it for the coins and everything, but there's so many things to learn about yourself within the work context. Reading about your work and how to be excellent in your work, you have to read it with the perspective of balancing out what you're learning about being a human and being yourself also. So that's why I still read a lot of books and content around my work because I still find relatable areas that help me think of problems differently, help me do things differently. So I think that pursuit of excellence in both your personal life and your professional life is something that people have to build. Being okay at things, being just okay, being an okay employee, being an employee who's like just not eligible to be fired, but not being top of the pack good. I think there's a lot of people who get into that comfort because we think work is like a punishment that we have to do to exist. But I think finding a balance where you incorporate work into who you are as a person and find ways to grow yourself through your work. Is something that has helped me a lot to get where I've gotten to, for sure, because I'm not just pursuing excellence in terms of the next promotion, I'm also pursuing excellence in the extent of how am I growing my communication skills in the workplace. I'm also borrowing those lessons to communicate better in my relationship, and I'm learning things from my relationship and how to, exercise empathy, do active listening, and I'm applying those in my role, which is also giving me fulfilling relationships with my coworkers. So creating like a synergy between all of those areas is something that might, like the result of it makes people think that the journey is kind of like effort. So just finding a way, your work and from your work.
Lovely. And on the mentorship aspect?
The mentorship aspect is tricky. I can say, like, I think you might be the only person who has this on record, but I was a victim of that. During my time at Microsoft, I, was being mentored by a very senior PM. And it started off as like very friendly, like somebody who's really willing to invest and advocate for you and show you the ropes on how to navigate in this huge company. And then it slowly became like meeting up for coffees, having more informal settings and stuff. And that kind of created expectations that, like you guys can have more, less and less and less professional relationships, right? So like,
Yes.
like now the lines start getting blurred. Now suddenly, this person has a child, you're asking about their child. Like, it's just weird stuff that you're like, hey, this is not even a relationship I would be having with a coworker. And this is now somebody who I don't even know that well. And where are these expectations coming from? So luckily for me, it didn't escalate to the point where some of the narratives you're seeing on Twitter has escalated. But the financial empowerment of people in tech has like subsequently created predators within the ecosystem, which means that because people are showing up as being very flamboyantly wealthy, you kind of use that perspective or like that image of yourself to seem more trustworthy or to seem like, hey, I can uplift you to this level. I used to be where you are. I know the road. So th they use that narrative to draw you in. And then because of their access to wealth, they introduce you to places where if you're just somebody who's coming up, you'll be impressed. Like this is somebody who's like, hey, when we're going for a road trip somewhere, you don't have to pay for anything. You see their car, they're driving very fancy cars, they pay for everything. You see a vision, you see a future of who you could be successful in your career. And these are the people who are embodying you it. And they're introducing you to their friends who are also similarly successful. So you feel like, wow. Like, I'm even networking with people in high places. And then suddenly you realize, and now there's a power dynamic. Like, you don't want to let them down, but they really haven't taught you anything tangible. They haven't gotten a job. They haven't introduced you to recruiters. But because you've met their two friends, you've driven around in your car, you feel like you're part of a stand to disappoint people. And women in tech are extremely more susceptible to that because, one, we know we are minorities. And two, even in rooms where we are minorities, we're still very, we've not gone past the age of thinking that that like salaries are standardized. There's still a little bit of paranoia that because you're not in the club, changing you, right? So you have to mingle with
Yes.
people socially to try and figure out, well, Connie, how much are people making? How are people able to buy all of these cars? Is there something I'm missing? So you try to engage socially. It reels you in. And because of like the fact that us as women in tech haven't also been 100% deliberate about prepping the younger women in tech about certain traps, they get susceptible and they get drawn into it. And then suddenly it even it's escalated, it's gotten sexual, it's gotten like to an extent where because you have been in compromising situations, they use it to threaten you. Like you can be in a very like blackmaily situation because you didn't have proper boundaries around your mentorship relationship with someone, and now you're getting taken advantage of. So as I mentioned in the panel we were in, having very strict very, very strict expectations, actually even relying on more asynchronous ways to do mentorship sessions is the best thing. So there's platforms like ADP List where the mentors are moderated, it's recorded in case of anything, like it's on the book. There's also ways in which you can give your mentor like a very clear layout of the specific areas that you want to be mentored in, so that you don't blur the lines. You just say like, hey, I want to get more, I want to get better with technical interviews. These are the gaps I have. Approaching a mentor and being like, hey, I'm looking for a mentor. Like for me, even though I offer mentorship, like I don't really take mentees who come with that approach seriously. The mentees I take seriously are those ones who come with very specific things. They tell me, hey, from your experience in this particular space, I'm having a challenge with this particular thing. Can I grab 30 minutes of your time to talk about one, two, three, four? That's a call I will always take. But people are like, so I don't like, what is the mentorship about? You know, like what do you want to be mentored in? Having those
Yes.
strict guidelines and foundations for yourself minimizes the chances of getting taken advantage of. And then also just being vigilant, right? Like, we as women in tech, we never want to seem like a nuisance. It comes with being a minority to some extent, because you're always like, hey, I don't want to be these characteristics that are blanketed for women seem inconvenient, right? So I want to be one of the bros. So I want to be as less maintenance as I can. But like, you have to be sensitive. You have to be sensitive for yourself. You just have to be like, hey, you know, the things you're saying are making me uncomfortable. Like, you have to be able to advocate for yourself. And whether or not that makes you feel like a burden, that's a muscle that women in tech have to build, to be able to speak out for any injustices that happen to them in behind closed doors, and to be able to consistently assert boundaries. That's something that I've realized, even women in C-suit who are in tech companies, that you have to be able to do that. And that means that sometimes you may come off as a bitch. Sometimes people will think that you're high maintenance, you're inconvenient, you're an asshole. But that's something you have to do to survive in this space. And we hope it gets better. But for now, it's something you just have to start exercising from, like even on an internship level.
So that's why, as you said, you are not the antagonist, so you're not afraid of being the bad guy, quote unquote, the bad guy.
You can't be afraid to be the bad guy, because in any situation that is beneficial for someone to be the bad guy, everybody's gonna want to have a bad guy. Like, they will make you a bad guy even when you're the victim, right? Like,
Yes.
you've seen cases of sexual assault victims being, accused of trapping the people who assaulted them, right? Like, why were you dressed like that? Like, how are you the bad guy and you're the victim, right? So people will
Yes.
make you the bad guy when they need to look for a bad guy. So might as well do what's best for you.
Right. That's spot on. Very spot on. And now, hey, today we've spoken. I knew this conversation would be so good.
I
Wow.
know, I
This
know.
conversation has
Are
been
we like
good, good.
literally almost at the 2 hour mark? You're gonna have to make a part one and a part two or something, because this
I
is
will. I definitely will. This is one of those episodes I've really enjoyed that.
me
Wow,
too, me too.
but I have one last question.
Your
Just
last,
one last one.
your last, your last.
Yeah, last, yeah, last, yeah, last. I only say when I have a good guest on board, I have very many last ones. So this one is the last one.
Okay.
It's a very light-hearted, full circle question.
Yeah, go
And
for
it's
it.
just in regards to talk to me about your relationship with your dad. You've spoken about your dad a lot. Such a beautiful relationship. Someone told me a girl's first love is her father. And clearly, you're the embodiment of it. I saw you guys working in Corona, and I was like, wow, I need to aspire to be this dad when I grow up. Because just like that quote said, your first, a girl's first love is the dad. The opposite is also true. Your first heartbreak is your dad, an absentee dad, or a dad who's abusive, or a dad who, all that stuff. So talk to me about this relationship and how you guys have been able to cultivate such a beautiful relationship where, as adults, you still have dates to talk about life, both professional, both personal. Whereas most people feel like once I leave my African parents' house,
Oh my
that is where
gosh.
I'm done. I can't wait to be seeing them once again in Christmas
Yeah.
and, pay my black tax, but we don't have any relationship. So talk to me about
Yeah.
that.
I mean, we've come a long way. We've come a very long way because I think when I started coming of age and like getting into my personality, we always had like difficulties kind of like aligning. I think there's always an expectation for parents to see the product of their hard work in you, and in areas where they feel like they've invested, like maybe like, oh, we took you to church every Sunday. How did you end up being like this? You know, like those things you have to expect your parents to be very passionate about. But the relationship that I have with my dad that has ended up, you know, serving it very positively is his ability to actually acknowledge when he is wrong. And that's something that I've always admired with my dad that I also practice in like my relationships. Like my dad will proactively, like, even if you guys like you know, go at it and it becomes really heated, if he does see the sense, if he does see your perspective, he'll actually come and tell you, okay. The way I reacted wasn't good. This is where it came from. He won't like say I'm sorry, but just knowing the acknowledging for me has made a hi really huge difference. Like it's made a huge difference because I feel like I can be hard. And I think that's the thing that we worked on during my adulthood. Like, yeah, me and you are gonna have moments where we both wanna have a conversation, but I know you want to know I'm hearing you, and you need to know I'm here. Like, I need to know you're hearing me. So I think we've come a long way with that. And also, I think, an activity we did while I was, you know, like after I moved out was really kind of exercising a lot of curiosity around their childhoods and who they are and some of the incidences that happened in their childhoods. I think as much as I don't want to, you know, give them like all this therapiness and like all of that, it's just those ones for kind of like for my own good, identifying where certain qualities they have come from. And so for me, I had a list in like my like one of my diaries of questions that I would love to know about like my dad, right? Like I'd be like, what was your favorite food growing up? Like what's a memory you have with your mom that you'll never forget? When was the first time you did this? Like exercising that level of curiosity kind of like humanizes your parent on some level, and also can even allow you to like see aspects of yourself in them, right? Like for me, you know, me asking him like, what was the biggest argument you ever had with your dad when he was still alive? And him telling me that, and him telling me how he reacted to certain things, I'm like, yeah, I see. I would do the same thing. Like I am my father's daughter in that perspective, you know? Yes, having those types of like interactions where you're like, what? On a deep level, like this is who this guy is as a person. It means that you are actually even able to decide whether you want to be the your parents' friend, right? Like, okay, the way you are, like, do I really want to be your friend? Like, if I was putting the same criteria I have for my friends on you, would you pass it, right? So me, you know, kind of having that kind of like relationship with him where it was like we decided we wanted to be friends with each other, like we have banter, like these things we can talk about, these things we know we can't talk about, like with each other, even having those conversations about those boundaries, like me being like, hey, yeah, like I know you might have challenges with my mom, but I still need to respect her, so I don't want to hear about your challenges. Like me, I'm still a kid, right? Like I know that I know I want to know you're okay, but I don't want you to give me details about the problems you're having with her because I love her too, right? So being getting to a point where we can have those types of conversations where I can assert my boundaries, where I can like tell my dad, like, you know, when you do this or when I ask you for advice and you respond like this, it makes me feel like you're trying to control me. And it takes a lot of vulnerability because you get to a level where you're so afraid of their reaction, but then you can kind of gauge it from the first one that you have. And so for me, taking the first step to be like, hey, when you do this, it makes me feel like this, risking it and knowing that this person can react extremely negative and it can become a lecture, or this can go well and they can be like, wow. And knowing that, they're probably not gonna take it well. So me, I said it and then I let him react. And then later I was like, you see, like that's why you see when you react like that, me. It makes it difficult for me to tell you other things and letting him think about that. Like, it have to be a discussion. So doing that enough times, it took a lot of vulnerability, it took a lot of patience, but I feel like we got into a cadence where it was like, oh, okay.
That's interesting, and that's good for you. I think having such relationships with your parents just gives you a different point of view on how you view the world, how you view things, and how, most importantly, you view yourself. Because a lot of people talk about childhood traumas and you know how they're being raised, but I think part of healing your inner child is just reconnecting to your parents and, you know, healing those parts that you think they didn't do right by you, or that you didn't do right by them as well, and just having those conversations. I love that for you. I hope a lot of us can take that bold step, because sometimes we always, I think as a generation as well, sometimes we don't offer and extend that grace to our folks, thinking they are the worst thing that happened to us. But you know, and thinking that they should be the ones to mend the relationship. But sometimes, really, we can be the ones to reach out and try to do that. Ikikata, imekata, granted. But you know, if you can, why not? So I'll let the listeners have a lovely week ahead, folks. Twitter us the good, the bad, and the Busharian. Follow us at. Hey, Germani guys, can you? Am I this old that I'm forgetting my outro? So let's try that again. So, tweet at us at the Busharian Pod. Follow us at the Good, the Bad, and Busharian. Tell us all the things you guys have loved about this two-part episode. Again, I hope to see you guys at the PodQuest on the 10th of December, where we'll be part of the climate sustainability and environmental conservation conversation. Come ready to have fun, to plant trees, to reduce a lot of carbon emission, to work as a team as well. That is very important. So, guys, have a lovely week ahead. Folks, and cheers.